A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. I was hoping to talk to Dan Schmutter, Second Amendment attorney up in New Jersey. In fact, we talked about Dan being on the program today, but unfortunately, Dan was having some internet connectivity issues. Tried and simply could not make it work. So we're going to get him on the program hopefully next week, talking about the amicus brief that he filed on behalf of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, I think Gun Owners Action League, and a few others as well, in Wolford versus Lopez. This is the case that the Supreme Court has already agreed to hear. Oral arguments are in January. This is over Hawaii's so-called vampire rule, right? The default ban on lawful carry and all publicly accessible private property. It's a really interesting amicus brief. It touches on the standard of review or the level of generality that courts are adopting when it comes to finding historical analogs, and like the egregiously awful level of generality that the Ninth Circuit took when upholding Hawaii's vampire rule. Anyway, we will get that conversation with Dan in the books here in the next few days, but apologies, we couldn't bring them to you today. So instead, I want to talk about something that's going on in California, something that may also very well face a lawsuit in the future, and perhaps even action by the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division's new Second Amendment section, because we are seeing stuff like this happen around the country as well, and it will have a major impact on our right to keep and bear arms. These are laws that are being put in place. They are not banning firearms. They are not regulating the manner of carry. In fact, they ostensibly aren't gun control restrictions at all, but they really are. Talking about using zoning laws to ice out gun stores in Marina, California. The city council there has extended a ban on new gun stores for further regulation planning. So, and we're seeing this too. City council will say, oh, you know, I'm really concerned about a gun store opening up maybe like a half a mile from a school. We have to investigate this. And so they'll direct their zoning commission or their zoning board, city attorney, whatever, to look into the issue. And in the meantime, they declare a moratorium on any gun stores opening up in their community. So Marina has had this moratorium in place for a while now, several months. But they're now extending this for another 10 months to give city planners, quote, more time to consider new regulations on where gun shops should be allowed and how many should operate in the area. The ban initially set to expire at the end of this month. There is one gun store in Marina, California. One. I don't even know that they've got any applications for any others. But the existing gun store, the owner there, Nanette Murphy, says, you know, I'm a little concerned about them changing the laws and me having to find a new location, especially with new ordinances put into effect. She says, look, I understand if you're close to a school or a daycare in the middle of a residential area, I can see where the concerns would be. Well, I'll be honest with you, Nanette. You know, we have plenty of FFLs who are actually, they don't have brick and mortar stores. They operate out of their homes. And you know what? I don't have a problem with that, and neither should you. In fact, you should be standing in defense of every FFL. I honestly can see where a gun store, let's say across the street from a school, you can run into problems with violating the Gun-Free School Zones Act, right? Which, again, is its own issues here. But I've never understood this idea that, you know, oh my gosh, this gun store is going to be, you know, 2 blocks away, 5 blocks away, a mile, 2 miles, we've even heard, away from a school, so therefore it can't open. Newton, Massachusetts, perfect example of this. And this was a couple of years ago, but there was a FFL. He had applied for and had obtained permission to open up a gun store in the small downtown area of Newton, Mass., which is a Boston suburb. After he was approved, the anti-gunners found out and started raising hell. Oh, no, we can't have it. Kids walk by that place every day on their way to school. And I never really understood what the implication was. Like, they were going to see I don't know, they're going to see an advertisement for a firearm and all of a sudden, you know, wet their pants, or maybe they were just going to, you know, an exposure to a gun store means these kids could grow up to be gun owners, but can't have that. I don't know what the objection was. But I did find it odd that already open for business, like I think it was two doors down from where the gun store was going to open, there's a marijuana dispensary. The parents didn't have any issue about that, about little Bobby and Jane walking by the Mary Jane store on their way to elementary school. Nah, that's fine. But, you know, again, a store selling products that are protected by our Constitution. Oh, no, that's a bridge too far. And the anti-gunners in Newton, Mass. Wanted to have a complete ban on gun stores in the town. We don't want them here. The I think it was the city attorney who said, you know, if we do that, we really open ourselves up to litigation. Can't really just say no gun stores allowed. But what we can do is zone gun stores in such a manner that there are really only a few locations that are available, right? And I think in Newton, it was basically like three or four parcels of land that were on the outskirts of town in an industrial area. City of Chicago did the same thing, actually, after the McDonald decision was handed down. You know, there were no gun stores in the city of Chicago. Right? To this day, I'm not sure there are any gun stores in the city of Chicago. No ranges. And the city rewrote its zoning laws. First, it tried to ban gun stores outright. And then they issued like a new zoning policy that I think it made something like 99.7% of Chicago off limits to gun stores. And the areas that were theoretically open to have a gun store weren't really publicly accessible, right? Like it wasn't like a street location. You had to like cross a railroad track in order to get to it. You know, again, these efforts are gun control laws. And more importantly, they are gun owner control laws. They are meant to stop people from exercising their Second Amendment rights. Now, these city council members could say, well, you know, somebody could always drive over to the next town. Well, what if the next town decides to do the same thing? And what about the town after that and the town after that? If you write these laws in such a way that it is logistically impossible to open up an FFL, and those laws are allowed to stand in one town, what's to stop another town, a neighboring town, from replicating those zoning laws? And again, in a, you know, part of the country as hostile to our Second Amendment rights as, let's say, like the Bay Area of California, you could end up with what amounts to a regional ban on gun stores, forcing residents to drive several hours to get to a part of the state that's 2A friendly, that has a big enough population base to support a gun shop, and that hasn't been put out of business by the other rules that the state of California and other anti-gun jurisdictions are putting on FFLs. You know, the mandates to have video and audio surveillance to maintain those recordings forevermore, all kinds of security upgrades, right? You know, this is another imposition on FFLs, but it is also another imposition on our right to keep and bear arms. KSBW in California spoke to John Moore, who's a customer of Nanette Murphy's. And he said, you know, it's more the safety of the guns I think is important, meaning how are they kept? Are they locked up? Good question, right? And again, you would think most gun store owners want to secure their inventory. Granted, we have seen stories where that has not been the case. But even then, by the way, California does have requirements for FFLs in terms of security. Even then, as John says, the issue is not where the shop is located, right? It's is the FFL operating in a manner that is safe and sound. But that's not the issue for the city council in Marina. Redwood City, California is another place that has issued a moratorium on gun stores. I'm not sure that that's been lifted. That was over a year ago, but I haven't seen any news about it being lifted. There were another umber communities in the Boston area that followed Newton's lead. We've even run across this in states like Alabama. There was a gun store that was slated to open kind of across the street and down the street from a daycare. And you had people objecting to this. I guess their concern is that somebody with evil intention is going to go to that gun store, buy a gun, and then as they leave the store looking for like their target of opportunity, they're going to spot that daycare and say, that's the place I'm going to. I guess. I don't know, but I mean, that's the only thing I can assume. But that's not how these depraved, twisted individuals who are intent on committing mass murder operate. Right? When you look at it, most of these attacks involve a fair amount of planning. They also involve a fair amount of fantasizing. Right? It's I won't say it's entirely unheard of, but it is exceedingly rare for one of these suspects to have decided on a Monday to go shoot up a school and then carry that attack out on Tuesday, right? Again, oftentimes we're talking about weeks, if not months, if not years of planning and, again, fantasizing about this. But also making public statements. You know, the Secret Service issued a report a few years ago showing that I think like 90% of cases of school shooters, that shooter had communicated a threat to somebody beforehand. Whether it was a classmate, a teacher, they posted something online, but they made their intentions known ahead of time. So the idea that you're going to stop some sort of crime against children by saying, you know, you can't open up a gun store within a mile or a mile and a half of any. Well, in Marina, they're looking at residential areas, schools, parks, liquor stores, and bars. Yeah. So you can't open within, let's say, half a mile or a mile of any residential area or any school or any park or any liquor store or any restaurant that serves alcohol. In a community the size of Marina, again, where does that leave gun stores able to operate? Not to mention, again, if you ban gun stores from all, or at least FFLs from operating in the residential areas, you could be impacting a significant number of FFLs who I would think would be able to bring a legal challenge of their own. So I bring this up because today is the day that the DOJ's Civil Rights Division is supposed to be opening up its new Second Amendment section, which is dedicated, again, to securing our right to keep and bear arms. We don't know what their first target's going to be. You know, Civil Rights Division has already filed a lawsuit against the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. They participated in oral arguments challenging Illinois' ban on so-called assault weapons and New Jersey's ban as well, I believe. They have authored some amicus briefs in defense of other challenges to state-level gun control laws. But we don't know what the Second Amendment section's first target of opportunity is going to be. And there are no shortage of potential places to litigate, right? I mean, besides the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, the city of Los Angeles is taking an egregiously long time to issue carry permits. Santa Clara County, talked about this just a few days ago. Nearly $2,000 to apply for a concealed carry permit. Between the, I think it's $1,100 you got to pay to the county, plus your mandatory psychological evaluation, plus your fingerprinting, plus your firearms training. And again, you're getting close to $2,000 to apply for a 2-year carry permit. Love to see the DOJ go after that. New York City, I don't know how many lawsuits have been filed against the NYPD's licensing division over delays in processing both carry permits as well as premises permits. But again, another place the DOJ has a target-rich environment if it wants to investigate Second Amendment abuses. But this, too, is something that the Second Amendment section should be paying close attention to. And when local communities try to use zoning laws as a way to chill the exercise of a fundamental civil right. I think they should absolutely be sued by the FFL, but I'd like to think that they're going to get some help from the DOJ going forward in the future as well. And, I know the second amendment section is going to be busy, but maybe they can find the time to write a letter to the Marina California City Council and warn them that what they're doing could bring them under the DOJ's microscope. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a disturbing case out of New York State. Suspect arrested in an attack on NYU student has lengthy criminal history, including 16 arrests. Most recently, October of 2023, this 45-year-old suspect was convicted of persistent sexual abuse and was sentenced to, you ready for this? 2 years in a New York prison for being a persistent sex offender. Yeah. Again, 16 arrests, not all of them for sex crimes. He's actually arrested and charged with attempted murder back in the late 1990s, too. But when I saw that, you know, it's infuriating, not just from the standpoint of you've got a persistent sex offender who's getting a slap on the wrist, 2 years behind bars. He was released in September, so he didn't even do the whole 2 years. And now, again, he's accused of assaulting this 20-year-old NYU student. As she's walking down the sidewalk, he is alleged to have come up behind her, grabbed her by the hair, slapped her on the butt, pulled her down to the ground. There were some good Samaritans who intervened, but God knows how much further that assault would have gone had those other good Samaritans not been there. This guy, again, 2 years for sexually assaulting somebody back in 2023. Dexter Taylor is doing 10 years in a maximum security prison in New York for making his own guns and not telling New York City about it. Not getting New York City's permission. 10 years. Charles Foner, we've talked about his case before. I remember he's the guy last summer who used a revolver in self-defense. He was a doorman at the time. And he was assaulted. Used a revolver to defend himself. No charges filed in the shooting of his assailant, who also had a lengthy criminal record and a documented history of mental illness, just like this individual that we're talking about right now. But though Charles Foner was never prosecuted for the shooting, he was prosecuted for owning that revolver and several other firearms that the NYPD found at his home that, again, were not registered. He had not applied for permission to own them. He was facing 25 years in prison. He ended up taking a plea deal. It looks like he's going to be sentenced to about 5 years in prison when he reports for his formal sentencing hearing in January. More than twice the amount of time that this persistent sex offender faced for his latest persistent sex offense. Owning a gun without first saying, "Mother, may I?" to the NYPD Licensing Bureau. 10 years, 5 years for those crimes that aren't crimes in the vast majority of states across the U.S. 2 years for sexually assaulting somebody in New York. Again, the two-year sentence is egregious enough, but when you compare it to what's happening to gun owners in New York, nonviolent offenders who make the mistake of thinking that New York respects their Second Amendment rights or even acknowledges their Second Amendment rights, again, it's absolutely infuriating. Today's armed citizen story from Houston, Texas. Suspect shot multiple times after Southeast Houston homeowner opens fire during an attempted break-in. This was late Monday night, early Tuesday morning. Two individuals try to break into this home in Southeast Houston. Homeowner, I guess, hears what's going on. He fires at these suspects. He hits one. The suspects, at least one of whom was armed, fire back, injuring the homeowner. The uninjured suspect scampers off into the night. Police haven't released any sort of description. No arrests have been made. Both the homeowner and the armed suspect who was shot were taken to a local hospital. At last report, they were both described as stable. So it looks like those injuries are not life-threatening. Would-be burglar, going to be facing some charges once he gets out of the hospital. The homeowner will not be, because he was acting to protect himself and perhaps others inside that residence. But again, this is a reminder, you know, and I don't want to be accused of, you know, ever saying, well, if you own a gun for self-defense, you never have to worry about being the victim of a violent crime. Yeah, you still do. Owning a gun is, it's not a suit of armor, doesn't grant you magic powers, doesn't make you invulnerable. You can still get shot. You can still be killed. There was actually a story a couple days ago about a guy in Miami who was being assaulted, drew his firearm, shot in self-defense. The guy who was attacking him grabbed the gun, shot and killed him. And as tragic as those circumstances are, you know, we shouldn't shy away from acknowledging them or discussing them. But they don't change the fact that having a firearm and being able to defend yourself, potentially, at least in my opinion, is a much better option than two guys who are armed themselves showing up at my door in the middle of the night, breaking into my home, and me not having a gun. Again, does having a gun guarantee that I'll be able to use it in self-defense? No. Does not having a gun guarantee that I will not be able to use it in self-defense? Absolutely. You know, it's not just my right to keep and bear arms, but in terms of personal safety, for me, it's a matter of being safe than sorry. But I am glad to hear that this homeowner in Houston is going to be okay. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A West Virginia man who rescued a woman from a burning car. Really, it sounds like with just seconds to spare. The woman, you know, West Virginia's mountainous state, right? So this woman was apparently driving down a mountain road. She got to the bottom of the mountain. Her mom's following behind her. They were on their way to an auto shop. So there may have been issues with the car's brakes beforehand. But anyway, mom said she saw the smoke coming out of her daughter's car. And I'm imagining those brakes were probably red hot, because if you are, you know, having to go down those twisty, windy mountain roads and you're having to hit the brakes quite a bit, it can do a number in a very short amount of time. The woman's daughter lost control of the car and ended up in a ditch. The smoke led to fire, and this woman's daughter was trapped inside. Becky is her name. There apparently were some good Samaritans who showed up, who tried to get her out of the car, but they couldn't because the flames were already so high. But then a guy named William Cole, goes by Bill, showed up at the scene. And he says he wasn't even supposed to be there. In fact, he says somebody he's never seen before blocked in his truck, don't know who this person is, and told him what was going on. And so Bill grabbed his shovel and ran towards the vehicle. He said when he got there, he busted out the back window, but then realized that Becky, the driver, could not get to the rear of the car because she was sort of pinned up in the driver's seat. So then he moved to the side of the car. Again, fire licking. It's, you know, the flames are there. The car's not fully engulfed yet, but the flames are there. He ends up breaking the driver's side window, is able to extricate her out of the car through the window because the door was stuck. And he said if it had been even 20 seconds later in terms of his getting there on the scene, it would have been too late. The car would have been fully engulfed. As it is, Becky was taken to a local hospital. She was ultimately airlifted to Pittsburgh to address burns on her legs. But she is expected to recover, which, again, just a few seconds later, and that would not have been the case. So, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for a stranger in need. Bill Cole, we thank you for your very, very good deed. And that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program, as always. Apologies that we're a little late getting this one posted today, but again, sometimes tech issues happen. Hopefully they will not happen on Monday, because we are slated to talk with Ashley Herblinski, the executive director of the University of Wyoming Law Center's Firearms Research Center. which just received a grant worth almost $1 million from the Department of Education to come up with a curriculum for K-12 students that talks about the Second Amendment, how it came to be enshrined in the Constitution, why it's there, and yes, the debate over its meaning, particularly since, you know, the late 1960s. I'm excited about this. You know, we talk a lot about the pro-Second Amendment moves that the Trump administration is doing with the Department of Justice, including the Second Amendment section. But providing a counter, a factual counter to the anti-gun bias in academia, particularly, again, in K-12 schools, right? That's huge. And I'm really looking forward to talking with Ashley about the particulars of this this grant and this new initiative. But anyway, we're going to do that on Monday. Between now and then, be sure to check out variantarms.com. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And if you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off your membership. Also, the Gundies are still open for voting. So if you go to thegundies.com, you can vote for folks like John Petrolino, Tom Knighton as best two-way writers. Variant Arms Cam and Company is up as the best podcast, one of the best podcast nominees. Certainly would appreciate your vote, but if nothing else, go and support John or Tom. Maybe alternate your votes between the two. But go to thegundies.com to participate. Have a good few days until we talk again. Hope you have a great weekend. Until then, be well. Be safe and be free.